This is Case Closed, crime stories from the golden age of radio. This is Case Closed. Welcome back. Thanks for joining me this Wednesday. We're going to start off this week with the adventures of Philip Marlowe and his story from September 10th, 1949, titled The Rust in Hickory. After that, it's Whitehall 1212 and the Case of Arthur Freeman, their story from February 10th, 1952.
Get this and get it straight. Crime is a sucker's road, and those who travel it wind up in the gutter, the prison of the grave. The lady tourist was a school teacher out after glamour, and she got it. But only after she learned that in Hollywood the 3 R's could be reading, done in a dark room, writing found in a dead man's pocket in arithmetic, that added up to murder times two.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of crime fiction, comes his most famous character in The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. Now, with Gerald Moore, starred as Philip Marlowe, we bring you tonight's transcribed story, The Rust in Hickory.
It was hot in my apartment, even at 10 o'clock at night. The sultry wind blowing through curtains at the far side of the room didn't help a bit. The kind of night that made me wish I was something else. A butcher, baker, candlestick maker, anything. After a long, hot day spent in the downtown courts of law, listening to the petty arguments of a petty larceny case, I was tired of petty people. The paper I had picked up on my way home wasn't helping any. 10 killed in an air crash. Mental cruelty, says local songbird. I made myself another highball. Lots of ice, easy with water. And picked up the paper again. It was still more of the same. Cy Nestor killed in office on Sunset Strip. Cy Nestor. He'd hit the papers before. Bookie, B-minus picture producer, general racketeer. Somehow I wasn't too surprised he was on the receiving end for a change. My drink was good for 10 more pages of equally dull reading, and I was set for the next in line when the phone rang.
Mr. Philip Marlowe?
It was the first attractive voice I'd heard all day.
Mr. Marlowe?
And you know, I thought she might be fun.
My name is Joan Rustin, and I'm only here in Hollywood from Ferndale, Nebraska, on a vacation, and I wanted to have some fun. You know, see the nightclubs and the stars and that sort of thing.
Wait a minute,
Joan. I don't want trouble, Mr. Marlowe.
At least of all, teacher. Hey.
Yes?
Let's back up a little, huh? Now, your name is Joan Rustin. You're from Ferndale, Nebraska, which you're right, I've never heard of. Also, you're a school teacher. That much I got. But the rest about the sights, the last part, the trouble.
Oh, but don't you see? They're the one and the same.
Oh?
I wanted to step out. Nightclubs, movie stars, glamour. But it didn't end up like that because he was shot and then I didn't know what to do. And his name's Aubrey Nickel. He's the man who took me out to show me the club. Anyhow, after it happened, I ran.
Why?
Why? The publicity, of course. Mr. Marlowe, I'd lose my job. You see, I'm a school teacher.
Yeah, you said that, honey. Now, look, where are you, Joan?
The Tulip Room. It's a bar on Sunset and La Cienega Boulevard. You'll come right over, huh? Huh?
Yeah, I'll come right over, huh? Goodbye, Joan.
Hey, Mr. Marlowe.
Yeah, but where are you?
Over here in this booth. Hurry.
Okay, hurry it is. Hello. Now tell me why all the secrecy and you... Oh.
And what? What are you staring at?
You. I expected braids, Joan. Horn rims, calico, maybe. Not ice blue satin, drape plunging, and,
Yes?
Yes. Start at the top, honey, and slow this time, huh?
Well, yesterday I met this man, this Aubrey Nickel I mentioned. Oh, he's really nice, Mr. Marlowe. He's a photographer, has a darling place up on the Sunset,
Sunset Strip. You went there to have your picture taken?
Uh-huh. I wanted something, well, something glamorous.
That's easy.
Look here what I got. Oh, by the way, I ordered a drink for you. A scotch drink. Here. You like scotch drinks, don't you?
Yeah, I, Scotch drinks are my favorite drinks, Joan, thanks.
You're welcome. Now, isn't it wonderful? The picture, I mean.
I'll say it is. I'd never say school teacher.
No, that's the idea. Just like a model in a fashion magazine, isn't it? Aubrey took it from inside his photo shop while I was outside on the street looking in his window. You know, like a smart career girl just strolling along the avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And see how he faded out the background? That way I'm the focal center.
Focal center.
Isn't it nice?
Oh, yes, it is, yeah. But look, Joan, the rest of the story. Now, the man was shot. You don't want publicity, remember?
Oh, yes, yes, of course. Well, we made a date, Mr. Marlowe, for tonight. I was to be at his place, his shop on the strip at 8, which I was. But when I got there...
He was gone.
Well, oh, he might just as well have been for all the attention he paid to me.
Huh?
He had something on his mind. Acted as though he didn't even expect me. Why, I had to mention his picture here twice before he got it out of the drawer for me. But then, just like that, he changed. Said if I wanted glamour and nightclub, why not?
Oh, by all means, why not?
And off we went to Cyrano's, no less, and sat at a table with two men and a woman who was actually Irmgard Fury.
Actually who?
Irmgard Fury, the starlet.
Oh.
Don't you read the papers? Oh, golly, her picture's been in every theater section and magazine for the last 6 months. Of course, she hasn't made a movie yet, but she probably will.
Wait a minute. Irmgard Fury, she has red hair, a figure, lots of each, huh?
Oh, that's right. Mm. Oh, and so sweet to talk to. Well, believe it or not, when we were in the powder room and she couldn't find her lipstick, she used mine.
Now, that's really democratic. Look, Joan, there was a shooting. You remember that. Now, you were sitting at a table with three men and this Irmgard Fury?
That's right.
Well, go on. What happened next?
Well, when Miss Fury and I got back to the table, Mr. Lacey and his friend were gone. And then a minute later, Aubrey excused himself to make a phone call.
And then?
And then a waiter brought me a note from Aubrey which said I should go back to my hotel and wait there till I heard from him. Then it happened.
Hmm. Look, Joan, if I'm going to help you on this, you got to tell the whole coherent story.
Well, suddenly there were some shots, maybe from outside, and people were yelling. It was terrible. I was scared to death, and I ran outside. People were crowded around someone. It was Aubrey. He was dead.
What'd you do then?
I took the first taxi I could get to my hotel, the Beverly Crest. I started from my bungalow, but didn't go inside because there was a man hanging around. I'd seen him before someplace, and I didn't like his looks, and turned away, and he called to me. Oh, he was awful, Mr. Marlowe.
Awful looking like a frog, maybe? Sloping shoulders, bulging eyes?
Yes, and when... Mr. Marlowe, how do you know what he looked like?
Promise not to tell.
Promise not to... Oh, Mr. Marlowe, he's here, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Been watching us for quite a while.
Oh, holy smokes, and I didn't get away from him. Oh, Mr. Marlowe, I had nothing to do with this shooting. What can I do? I simply can't be mixed up in this terrible business. Oh, please, Mr. Marlowe, I'll pay you anything. Only get me out of this, please.
We'll talk about that later, Joni. Now, look, when we get up, keep talking and don't look away from me. Then when we're outside and around the taxi stand there, duck away from me fast and get in close to the building and stay there till the frogman is gone. And head for your hotel bungalow and wait till you hear from me. Now, you got that?
Well, yes, but I don't understand why he's going to leave us.
You will, if our little coup works. Come on. It played easier than I'd expected because, like a good shadow, the frogman gave us a small head start, which was all I needed. The second Joan darted away from me, I moved quickly up to the first cabin line, opened and slammed the rear door fast, said goodbye out loud to Joan, who was not in the back seat, then slipped the driver five, winked hard, and practically shouted a very faraway address at him. When he lurched from the curb, I stood there and waved a minute. It was what was still supposed to be Joan. Then, even as I saw the frogman dart across the street, pile into his own car and take off after the cab, I walked slowly back into the bar where I had another scotch drink and did some fast checking on the current location of Aubrey Nichols, which was the Dawson Memorial Hospital. Then I started outside for my car after stopping en route at the booth where Joan and I had been sitting to pick up a pair of gloves and glamour portrait my new little client had left on the seat. The schoolmarm had been upset indeed.
Dawson Memorial Hospital, Dr. Chambers?
Yes, one moment, please. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
Oh, I want to know the condition of a patient who was brought in here a little while ago, Mr. Aubrey Nichol.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. We're not allowed to give out such information. You'll have to inquire at the superintendent's office. Sir, Dawson.
I wouldn't bother, Phil.
Well. Detective Lieutenant Matthews, good evening.
Good evening. Nichol is dead, Marlowe. We did not get a statement from him.
That's too bad. Any idea who did it?
No. Have you?
I didn't even know him. A client of mine.
Yeah, Mr. Smith.
That's right. That's remarkable. Yeah, Mr. Smith. He asked me to inquire about his condition.
Well, it happened about an hour ago in an alley behind Cyrano's. Aubrey Nichol was a photographer up on the strip, but pretty much of a phony. A big front boy, strictly.
That's all there was to it, huh?
Walk down here with me a little.
Oh, sure, sure.
We figure there may be some connection between this shooting and Cy Nestor's death this afternoon. Nestor also had an office on the strip.
What do you figure the tie-in is, Matthew?
Man named Ham Lacey. Ever hear of him?
Yeah, he was one of Nestor's number one boys in the racket, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Hmm.
Of course, officially, Ham Lacey is known as the vice president of Nestor Enterprises Incorporated. Also production manager of that second-rate movie studio Nestor owns. Well, anyway, Lacey, another man, and Aubrey Nickel were at Cyrano's tonight with a starlet named Ermgard Fury. And another gal we haven't been able to tag yet. Now, tell
me, wait a minute, Lieutenant. When Nestor was killed, did it look like the usual mob tactics?
No, no. Nestor was beat up by fists. Not sapped, not cut up with brass knuckles. Their death was caused by a blow to the temple from a poker that was standing next to a phony fireplace in which he could have hit his head when he fell.
Well, probably not Lacey and Associates, huh?
Probably not. He's got an alibi.
Yeah?
Besides, we already got a fair line on who did it and why. We found a note in Nestor's pocket signed D. Tobin, which threatened Nestor with a beating if he didn't stay away from the undersigned's wife and send her back home at once. Nestor, you may or may not happen to know, had this Imgard Fury or something under contract to him, saw lots of her. So, again, the two deaths more or less tie together.
Yeah, you've already talked to... by the way, her name is Imgard Fury.
No, I ain't talking. I figured I'd wait till I knew a little more. Also, I didn't figure Nickel would die without saying anything.
No.
Well, now it's your turn. We found this negative in the alley near Nickel's body. This is a night shot of the Sunset Strip and nothing more. Means anything to you?
No, why should it? Now, look, I told you before, Lieutenant, I never even met Nickel.
Yeah, and I listened, didn't I?
I noticed.
But now let's level a bit, huh, Phil? Who your client is and what he or she has to do with this is one thing as long as we're both on the same side. But playing dumb when it might count is quite another. Now, once more, Phil, huh? The picture?
Still zero, Lieutenant. Honor bright. Anything else?
Yeah, just to save you a little time, Phil.
Yeah, let's do.
Ermgard Fury's address, 441 West Bedford Drive, Beverly Hills. You got a
441 West Bedford Drive.
Now, play it close. Be sure to call when you think it's time. And if you're wondering about why all this help from me, try this. What you know and won't tell, plus what I know and will tell, might do the trick. Say goodbye to me, Phil.
Goodbye.
Yes?
Miss Fury, my name's Philip Marlowe. I must talk to you at once.
About what?
Your husband. I'm a friend of his, and he asked me to get in touch with you. It's because of what happened this afternoon up on the Strip.
Oh? Well, what's wrong is... Dave here in town? Right?
Yeah, he is, and he's in trouble. You see, the police are after him.
All right, hold it, mister. You've said enough.
Huh?
What are you, cop or reporter?
Oh, now, wait a minute, Miss Fury. I've already told you I'm a friend of Dave's.
Whose name happens to be Douglas. Mr. Douglas Tobin. Keep that in mind when you try this next time. Good night.
Not so fast, baby. The mistake was mine, but I still want to talk to you.
So do a lot of men.
I'll bet.
Now, beat it before...
Thank God.
Before I forget myself.
What's the trouble, Ermgard?
Oh, no trouble, Hamilton, darling. This gentleman was just leaving. He had the wrong address. He made a mistake, didn't you, Mr. Marlowe?
Yes, a blunder. 1,000 apologies and good night, Mrs. Tobin. What it was worth, it worked. At the mention of the name Tobin, Ham Lacey spun around like he was built on a pivot, and his eyes, that were narrow slits with all the come-hither look of a cobra's, never left me. As I slowly walked away from him and past the yellow convertible he'd just driven up in. License number 6969X, California. And on out to the street. All of which only meant that Lieutenant Matthews was probably right about there being some connection between Cy Nestor's murder and the death of Aubrey Nickel. When I opened the door of my car and started to climb in under the wheel, the voice in the night helped not at all.
If you don't do as I say, I'll kill you.
Okay.
Knock it out.
Take it easy.
All right. Now close the door and turn around. You're back to me.
Now look, if this is a stick-up, Busty, you can save us both a lot of time.
Shut up. I'm not a hold-up man. Now move over there, close to those trees. Go on. I'll ask you a question. All right, that's far enough. Now, what have you got to do with Helen?
Helen who?
Helen Tope. Ermgard Fury, that's what she's known as now. What have you got to do with her? Tell me.
Very little, Mr. Tobin.
Tobin? Do you know who I am?
And so do the police. But why don't you call it quits while you're still in one piece?
No, not quits. That's what you want, what all of you want. Me arrested and out of the way in jail and maybe out of the way for good. No. But that won't be. Helen's mine and you're not going to harm her.
Careful, Tobin, you're getting excited.
Yes, excited enough for this. Go!
In just a moment, the second act of Philip Marlowe. But first, A thrill a minute, high-tension suspense from the word go, dramatic excitement that builds and builds until it explodes in a smashing climax. That's Inner Sanctum, the great mystery show that's another of CBS's top-notch Monday night programs. You'll find Inner Sanctum one of the most entertaining spots in your Monday night listening schedule. And remember, Lux Radio Theater is back for its 15th year of great dramatic presentations. Inner Sanctum and Lux Radio Theater every Monday night over most of the same CBS stations. Now with our star, Gerald Moore, we return to the second act of Philip Marlowe and tonight's story, The Rust in Hickory.
When the whirling pinwheels of light slowed down to being street lamps again, Douglas Tobin had pounded shoe leather on enough sidewalk to be safely out of sight. But it took a full minute of rubbing the bruise where his pistol had glanced off my head before I finally remembered that it was a good time to call Joan. I looked back at Ermgard Fury's house first and saw the light still on, the cream-colored convertible still parked in front and all apparently quiet inside. So I limped as far as the phone booth on the corner. I warned my client that the trick we pulled on the frog wouldn't hold up forever. But instead I found out just how far this side of forever it had collapsed.
Yeah, hello.
Hello. Hey, what number is this? What are you doing there? Where's Joan Rustin?
Oh, the babe's here, but she ain't in much of a mood to talk. Incidentally, thanks for giving me this free time, Dibby.
What are you talking about?
That fast shuffle you tossed me, Dibby. That now you see her, now you don't gag with the taxi. For an old shell game operator like me, that one was as tough to see through as a glass-bottom boat.
All right. You get your diploma in the morning, but listen, you, if anything happens to Miss Rustin, I'll break
it. Skip it, Dibby. You're wasting your breath. It's already happened. I'll see you around. So long.
Oh. Joan, come on, baby. Come on, snap out of it.
Oh, stay away from me.
Hey.
Get out of here, you ain't
hold it. It's me, Joanie. Marlowe.
Marlowe.
Yeah.
Oh, Marlowe.
Come on, honey. What happened? Are you hurt, Joan?
That man, the one with the gruff voice.
Yeah.
He forced his way in here, Marlowe. He was looking for something. I tried to stop him. I was going to scream, but I guess that's when he put the bite on me.
That slug, baby.
Well, anyway, he hit me hard. And I've never been treated that way before in my whole life.
You've never been buddies with murder before, either. Come on, honey, get up off the floor, huh? Easy now. There. Hey, he turned your place inside out, too, didn't he? What was he after, Joanie?
Oh, I don't know. He just told me to quit stalling and hand it over. I didn't know what he meant, so he shoved me. Then he pulled out all the books there and tore up the rugs.
He was looking for something small and flat like a... Wait a minute. Sure. The cops found a negative near Aubrey Nickel tonight, but it was worthless. There must have been another one, an important one. And Lacey and Froggy, who no doubt is Helm Bay, must think you've got it.
Me? Well, that's impossible. All I had was my picture, and, well, I don't even have that now.
No, but I do, out in my car, and it gives me a great idea. Come on.
Well, where, Marlowe? I don't get it. What's my photograph got to do with this?
Maybe plenty. You see, when Aubrey printed that picture of you, he faded out the background almost completely. You remember?
Uh-huh.
That's a stunt in fashion photography to make a subject stand out. In this case, Joan, I figure it was played strictly in reverse.
Well, how do you mean?
That Aubrey took you to Cyrano's tonight on business, big business. And you were holding the merchandise for him all the way.
Oh.
Here. Let's take a look.
Oh, Marlowe, my pretty picture frame.
Better this than your pretty head later, sweetheart, believe me. Uh-huh, yeah, here it is. Look, see? A negative the size of a postage stamp. But I'll bet old flash bulbs the $10 bills this baby's really loaded.
Marlowe.
Hmm?
I'll bet that baby's loaded, too.
What are you talking about?
The gun in that man's hand there behind you.
Oh, fine.
Wait. Easy, Marlowe. I'm not looking for any more trouble. I just want to be sure that you'll help me first. You're a private detective. I searched you before, so I know. I'm in a jam. It's worse than I figured. The cops are after me for murder.
No kidding. I can't understand it, Tobin. All you got is a motive deep enough to swim in, and you've been dropping clues like Hansel and Gretel dropped pebbles.
All right, but I didn't do it. Well, I beat up Cy Nestor, sure, but he was going with Helen, my Helen. I hated everything and everybody in this phony town because they took her away from me. Even changed her name for her, Ermgard Fury. But I didn't kill Nestor. I swear I didn't. You've got to help me, Marlowe.
With that 38 in your fist, are you asking or telling?
Oh, I'm asking, brother. Here, take it. Take the gun. I'm in a fix, and I know it.
Okay, hothead. I'm already in Dutch for hiding Matthew's key witness here. Think how I'll look keeping his chief suspect under wraps, too. Yet, Oh, maybe I'm a sucker, but I believe you. All right, where do you hang your hat?
The Country Cottage is number 7. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a motel court down on Melrose Street.
Number 7. Now go there and stay out of sight. And I mean stay out of sight.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Thanks, Marlowe. Say, I'm sorry I batted you down tonight.
That makes a lot of difference to the lump on my head. Go on, Tobin, beat it.
Okay.
I'll keep in touch with you.
Where are we going, Marlowe?
Call a friend of mine. We need a big enlargement of a small negative. Hiya, Shermie. This is Phil Marlowe.
No kidding. Gee, how's business, Phil? Long time no see.
Yeah, I know. Now, look, are you busy? I got a job that's right down your alley, Sherman. It's important.
What is it, Marlowe?
Well, it's a 35-millimeter negative. I want it blown up to about half as big as a house.
Okay, bring it in.
I can't. I've got to check a couple of other things at the same time. Now, look, Shermie, can you meet me at the Aubrey Nichols studio on the strip in about 10 minutes, back door?
Wait a minute. Back door?
Yeah.
How come, Phil?
So we can kick it in without attracting too much attention. Shermie, I'll see you in 10 minutes. I piled Joan into the car, drove down the strip, and once past Nichols' studio, which was enough. Joan had posed for a picture in front of the place, and directly across the street, behind her, just as I knew it had to be, was a neat plastic sign reading Cy Nestor Enterprises on the diminutive but glossy imitation Swiss chalet where Nestor's body had been found. We turned double back through the alley and found Sherman bobbing up and down like a nervous gopher. 5 minutes of not-so-subtle persuasion got us past the lock and inside Aubrey's studio where something else checked. The walls were practically papered with pictures of Ermengarde Fury, taken from every conceivable angle, including some that were not. Things were beginning to make a lot of sense.
Marlowe, is this all right? Coming in here, I mean, it's sort of uninvited and all.
Breaking and entering, lady. You can get 5 years for it. I sure hope you know what you're doing.
Yeah, this must be the dark room. Yeah. Now, here's the negative, Shermie. Do your stuff.
What do you really expect to find on the film, Marlowe?
A murderer, baby. It's got to go one of two ways. Douglas Tobin for jealousy or Ham Lacey for ambition. Aubrey Nichol caught one of the two in the background when he took your picture. And he was familiar enough with all parties concerned over there to think he could put the screws on somebody. How's it coming, Shermie?
He could get out in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
15 by 20, okay?
Yeah, it's good. If there isn't a man in the background, I'll eat it.
You better get the salt and pepper, pal, because it's nothing but a car. See?
It can't be. Oh, brother, that's more than a car, Shermie. It's a yellow convertible that belongs to Ham Lacey. Look, you can even see the license, 6969X.
696? Oh, now how do you suppose...
What's the matter, Marlowe?
I just thought of something. Without this picture, both Tobin and Lacey are suspects. But with it, we have proof Lacey is implicated. That means Lacey thinks he has Tobin sitting in the perfect frame, right where he wants him.
Oh, Marlowe, listen.
Now, look, you two get out of here. Go back to the paper. I've got to get to Tobin fast and let him know.
Oh, Phil, listen,
look, baby, you're no doubt terrific in the third grade. But some things they don't even teach in college are going to pop any minute, so I'll take it from here, huh? Stick with Shermie, honey. I'll call you.
Oh, but Marlowe, wait, listen.
I made it from the strip down to Melrose and then east to the cluster of dusty lean-tos with baths known as country cottages in something under 10 minutes. Parked down the street and cut back through the alley on foot. I got to the door of cottage number 7 with about 30 seconds to spare.
Now, wait a minute, mister. You got me wrong.
Oh, no, I haven't, pal. You can tell me you didn't knock off Cy Nestor, and I'll believe you. But nobody else will. I've got you right where I want you.
Now, wait a minute.
Because of your note found in Nestor's pocket. You're the jilted boyfriend, the hick from back home, who came to Hollywood with murder in your heart and knocked off the guy who stole your wife.
Now, look,
yeah,
you're...
and then you went after the cheap photographer who gave her her stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And after that, you knew you couldn't escape, so you blew your brains
out.
And by the time I leave here, that's the way it's going to look.
Not tonight, Ham.
But, yeah,
stand still, Lacey. Toss the gun over on the bed. Go on. That's better. So you figured Aubrey was lying about having a picture that pegged you as Cy Nestor's killer, didn't you? You figured Aubrey saw something but had no proof, so you shot him. But you were wrong, Ham. He had all the proof we need.
Come on,
let's go! Joan, who's out there?
Oh, Phil.
Joan.
Phil.
Joan, are you all right?
Jerry, I hit her. She's the one who killed Cy Nestor. I tried to tell you that. I followed you here to tell you, but instead I saw her with a gun pointed at you. I grabbed the first thing I saw, this broken rake handle, and I hit her with it. I hit her awfully hard, Phil. But she isn't moving. You don't think she's...
Dead? No. She's probably thinking over the big lesson you just taught her with that stick there.
Why? Well, what's the matter?
Hey, Teach, you know what that rake handle's made of?
Why, well, it's hickory, isn't it?
Yeah. What else could it possibly be but a hickory stick?
All right, Marlowe, all right. Nobody can hear us. Now, what is it?
Well, it's that Miss Rustin here is a schoolteacher, Matthews, and it's imperative that we keep her name out of this.
Oh, well, we can arrange that.
Oh, good. You know, Matthews, it's funny how one step leads to another.
Yeah?
Ham Lacey never would have gone so far as to kill Nestor on his own. But when he learned that Ermgard had done it, he saw an opportunity to turn the whole situation to his advantage. He and the girl agreed to frame Tobin and then go along as a team.
You know, of course, that that's just your theory.
Just a minute.
Now,
what do you mean?
Sit down over there and be quiet for a change while Miss Rustin and I wind this up.
Matthews, listen.
Now, quiet, please.
Pulling rank, huh?
Phil. Now, Miss Rustin, in solving this case...
Just
you,
a minute. She didn't solve the case. I...
Miss Rustin, if you hadn't solved it, and right when you did, you'd be talking to this guy exclusively via Ouija board from now on. Let's face it.
Oh, what a corny pitch.
Now, tell me, Miss Rustin, how did you peg Ermgard Fury?
Well, when we got the picture of the yellow convertible, I remembered that I'd gone to the powder room at Cyrano's with Miss Fury to freshen our makeup. But she couldn't find her lipstick. She emptied her purse looking for it, and she finally had to borrow mine, you know.
Oh, how democratic.
I said that.
So now you own it? Now tell me, Miss Rustin, how do you figure the lipstick figures?
Oh, it wasn't the lipstick. I happened to notice among the things from a purse a keychain, a chain with car keys on it, and an identification tag in the form of a little license plate.
Oh, and the numbers were...
6969X.
That's right.
And since Ham Lacey had an alibi and those keys were in Miss Fury's bag, you figured it was her who'd been driving.
It was she who'd been driving, yes.
Isn't this revolting?
Yeah, she. Yeah. She wanted to kill Nestor because he wouldn't turn loose of her so she could claw her way on up to the bitter top. And when she found him unconscious, it was easy.
How literary.
Well, that's that, I guess. Thank you very much, Miss Rustin. I hope your stay in our town has been... Oh, what's the matter?
Tony, baby, don't cry.
I just thought of the most dreadful thing. I've had a wonderful time. I went to Cyrano's. I hit a movie star on the head, and I helped solve a murder. But I'll never, ever be able to say one single word about it to anybody in Ferndale, Nebraska. Darn it all.
It took a few minutes to put on a new touch of mascara and get the pink off her nose, but she was smiling again when we said goodnight to Matthews and stood on the steps at headquarters and looked at the glittering lights of Hollywood. There was still plenty of time for supper and even a dance or two, and she wanted to go. But suddenly, from somewhere, there was a smell of autumn in the air, of dry leaves on the ground and ripe red apples for the teacher. She shook her head wistfully and spoke of an appointment she had bright and early next Monday morning. Oh, I took her to a hotel and said goodbye. All the way home, for some reason, I kept wondering, whatever happened to Skinny McDonald? The only kid in school who could shoot a better spitball than Marlowe. Has it really been that long ago?
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe star Gerald Moore and are transcribed and directed by Norman MacDonald. Script is by Mel Donnelly, Robert Mitchell, and Gene Levitt. The special music is composed and conducted by Richard Arant. Be sure and be with us again next week when Philip Marlowe says...
There was a tapestry found under a tomb. They were all after it. The worried importer, the man with half a face, the Englishman in an L.A. slum... and the lady wearing a green veil. But before it was over, none of them had it, and two of the four were dead.
Now, stay tuned for Gangbusters, which follows immediately over most of these same CBS stations. This is Roy Rowan speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Whitehall, 1212.
This is Scotland Yard.
For the first time in history, Scotland Yard opens its secret files to bring you the authentic stories of some of its most baffling cases.
These are the true stories, the unvarnished facts, just as they occurred, reenacted for you by an all-British cast. Only the names of the participants have, for obvious reasons, been changed. The stories are presented with the full cooperation of Scotland Yard.
Research on Whitehall 1212 is prepared by Percy Hoskins, chief crime reporter for the London Daily Express. The stories for radio are written and directed by Willis Cooper.
I am Chief Richard Anderson of Scotland Yard. Murder with a gun is not common in Britain, but Anthony de Bruin was shot to death. I would like you to see the evidence that led us eventually to the murderer. This is Chief Superintendent John Davidson.
And you're standing in Scotland Yard's Black Museum, of which I have the honor to be the custodian. Now, while we have certain extremely gruesome objects in these two rooms, many of them are quite innocuous when taken out of context. They're here not as ghoulish exhibits for the morbid, but as examples for study by our people in connection with their jobs. Now, such an exhibit is this one in case number 160277. Now, this is an ordinary cheap raincoat.
Identical
with those worn by thousands of men. Identifying tags of all kinds had been removed. It was completely anonymous. Our people thought it might be an important clue to the identity of the murderer. It seemed impossible. But my good friend Inspector Anderson here followed this extremely tenuous clue to the end.
Almost to the end, sir.
What do you mean, Inspector?
I wasn't present when they were hanged, sir.
The crime. At 10 o'clock of the morning of April 3rd, 1947, Anthony de Bruin, a young stockbroker's clerk, was walking with his fiancée toward Howard's Jewelry Shop in Charlotte Street near Tottenham Court Road in London. They were on their way to purchase an engagement ring.
Or at least 6 carats, darling.
Set in platinum, too.
I wish I could afford it, really, though.
Whatever it is, I'll love it, Anthony.
Well, come on. Let's see what I can afford, shall we?
Darling.
Hey! Hey!
Robert!
Out of the road, there you go!
Oh, my God!
From Inspector Anderson's first notes on case 160277.
Robbers wore white cloth masks. Faces not seen by anyone at murder scene. Apparently young men. No jewelry taken. De Bruin only casualty. Shot through head. NB, pathologist extracting bullet for examination. Gun not found. Apparently taken with him by murderer. Girl hysterical, unable to talk coherently. Witnesses to murder unable to identify. Murder and companion disappeared inside business building at number 14 Charlotte Street.
Interview with Thomas Cobley, porter at number 14, by Detective Sergeant John Quinn of Scotland Yard.
Oh, I've seen him all right, sir. See this knob on me end? One of them hit me with a bleeding great pistol as he ran past me, sir. After that, he tried to shoot me, but the thing wouldn't go off.
Could you recognize either of them again, Cobley?
Well, that I could, sir. Both of them had their masks hanging about their necks. I've seen their faces all right. I'd recognize the one with the mustache anyway, sir, I think.
You know how they were dressed?
Well, one of them had on a raincoat, sir. The other one, well, I'm afraid I don't remember, sir. But I'd know him again, sir.
Interview with Police Constable Roy Harris on point duty near the rear entrance to number 14.
Yes, Sergeant. It was them, all right, I'm sure. Two men answering to Cobley's description came running out of the rear entrance at 10-7, Sergeant. I saw the one with the moustache.
Would you recognize him again, Constable?
Oh, I'm sure I would, Sergeant. However, I didn't notice the raincoat. In fact, I'm sure that neither of them wore one.
But you would recognize them again, though?
Positively, Sergeant. Raincoat or no raincoat.
Inspector Anderson of Scotland Yard.
We found the raincoat 3 hours later.
It had been hastily tucked in a dark corner of the hallway at number 14, through which the men had apparently run. Yes, it was the same coat you saw in the Black Museum a few moments ago. The manufacturer's label had been removed, so had the label of the shop that had sold it. Contained no initials, no marks of any sort. A shabby, shapeless garment that might have been worn by anyone. In the right-hand side pocket was a caliber 45 automatic pistol, the type used by the American Army. It had apparently been fired twice. A clip containing four ball cartridges was still in place, with an additional one in the chamber. I took it myself to Chief Inspector Carl Tree in the ballistic laboratory.
I had it checked, Anderson, for fingerprints.
And?
None, of course. Let's use one of those shells.
Tom, did you fill the catchman box with cotton wool?
Yep.
All right, stand aside, Anderson.
All right, Tom. Get it out, will you, please?
All right,
sir. First time I've seen that, sir.
Aye, they're sending us up the bullet they're taking out of this chap's head.
Postmortem must be about finished.
Then we'll put them both under the comparison microscope and see for certain if this is the gun they both came from.
Quite. I'll be waiting, sir.
Aye. We'll let you know at once.
By the next afternoon, the 4th April, we were certain. This was the murder gun. Ergo, the raincoat had probably belonged to the murderer, the man with the moustache, who, we had been assured, could be readily recognized. If we could find him, that would be difficult. I put criminal records onto it. They produced some 150 dossiers of known criminals whose take ran to robbing jewelry shops and or carrying guns. Further checks showed that the pistol had been stolen from the U.S. Amphibious Engineer Regiment in June 1946. There was no clue to the thief, the American Army DCI informed us. The porter Cobbley remembered that the men had worn gloves. The constable said that he did not see the direction they had gone. They simply lost themselves in the crowd of passers-by. Quinn and I went over the anonymous raincoat again.
I haven't been able to discover anything, sir. He's done a good job. Every single identification that's visible to the naked eye's been removed.
How do you know?
Well, I compared it with me own and Nobby Clark's and yours, sir. All the tags on this one are gone.
I wonder if he removed things that aren't visible to the naked eye.
You mean things you might find with ultraviolet or infrared light, sir?
I was thinking of something else.
What, sir?
Give me a razor blade, Quinn.
You're going to rip the coat apart.
I was lucky. The first cut I've made. The seam where the left sleeve was attached to the coat itself revealed a tiny stamped paper tag sewed inside the lining. It was a kind of manufacturer's stock tag. Photographs were quickly made, circulated to every manufacturer of raincoats in the country. That took a week, but a firm in Leeds identified it at once as one of theirs. The coats, they said, bearing that stock number, had been sold to shops in southeast London, either Deptford or Bermondsey. Well, thank heaven for forgers, Quinn, I said.
That I don't get, sir.
Look, A, people forge clothing coupons.
Yes, sir.
B, when you buy clothing at any store in London, the shopkeeper puts down the number of the coupon book, what you've bought, and your name.
Why, oh, that's right, sir.
Go and find me the names of the people who bought these coats, Quinn, my lad.
That wasn't quite as simple as all that. But it wasn't so hard either. There had been 24 dozen of that lot of raincoats sold in those two districts, and we accounted for all but six of them. Inspector Anderson and I went over the list of 282 names. We found not one name we'd ever heard of, and criminal records reported that none of them were known in their files. Well, it was a good try, sir, I said to Inspector Anderson.
Well, we still haven't checked on each of these names personally.
We'll have to do it, sir, I expect.
Quite. Well, gird up your loins, Quinn.
Sir, they're right up under me chin now.
I was just thinking of something.
Sir?
Got your own book of clothing coupons on you?
Yes, sir.
Let's see them, will you?
Yes, sir.
Sign?
Sign it myself, sir. What's the matter, sir?
What's your name?
John Quinn. You know that, sir.
This is signed Quinn John.
Well, by crikey.
And mine is signed Anderson Richard. Let's look at this list again, the hind end too.
Yes, sir. Clancy Oliver.
That'd be Oliver Clancy.
Gold Joseph.
Never heard of Joe Gold.
Johnston John.
Nor John Johnson.
Sheehan Robert.
No one could be named Sheehan Robert. We're right, old boy.
Freeman George.
George Freeman.
Mullen.
Crikey, I remember that name.
So do I, sir.
But he died last month.
Yes, sir. Smashing grab feller. Real white boy. I remember. Killed in a bus accident in Clerkenwell.
He must have bequeathed the coat to somebody, mustn't he?
Hmm. You know, I seem to remember he had a kid brother in Borstal, sir.
Check up and see if he's still there. If he's been let out, I shall very much want to talk with young Mr. Freeman.
In the room in Clerkenwell where George Freeman had lived prior to his untimely death, Sergeant Quinn found the younger brother, Arthur, who had been released from a Borstal reformatory only a few weeks before. He was quite willing to accompany the sergeant to Scotland Yard, where Inspector Anderson interviewed him.
Sit down, Freeman.
Don't mind if I do.
We found your raincoat, Freeman.
Did you?
Yes.
Who had it?
What?
Oh, I lent it to a fella.
Who?
I'm not a copper's mark, Mr. Inspector.
You lent it to someone, then?
Yes. Listen, Nick, what do you want of me?
We want some people to see you.
What about?
Oh, a little affair up Tottenham Court Road, right?
Oh, that fellow got murdered.
Right.
Well, who wants to see me?
I should think you could guess.
Oh, to no good, I wasn't there.
That you can prove, no doubt.
Oh, I've got an alibi.
I'd be glad to hear about it.
I'll tell you when the time comes. I've got it all right.
I expected you would have one.
How did you know it was my raincoat?
It was your brother's, wasn't it?
You're pretty smart.
Thank you.
But not as smart as you think, Mr. Inspector.
Have you any objection to appearing at an identification parade?
Me? Other people going to appear with me?
Of course.
Same size as me?
Mm-hmm.
Same build?
Mm-hmm.
So forth?
Naturally.
Well,
if you're afraid you'll be identified, Freeman.
Nobody will identify me.
Well, in that case, I shouldn't think you'd object.
I'm not objecting.
Well, then.
I just don't want to be framed.
You needn't worry about that.
Oh, oh.
Take it or leave it, Freeman.
Heads you win, tails I lose, eh? If I won't do it, you lock me up and...
I'll arrest you on very definite suspicion. Yes.
And if I do, you'll contrive some way to point me out to the...
Look here, Freeman, I'm trying to be fair.
Oh.
I won't even go in the room where they're having the identification parade.
Huh? You'll leave me go as soon as it's over?
If you're not identified, yes.
Nobody'll identify me.
All right.
All right, then. I'm not afraid.
Sergeant Quinn.
Yes, sir.
Quinn, this gentleman's for the identification parade. Will you show him the way, please?
Oh, yes, sir. Well, will you come with me, please, sir?
Lead the way, my good man.
Thank you.
You want to know who I lent that raincoat to?
I'd be most interested.
Tell you what I'll do.
I got an idea. That raincoat was found somewhere near that Charlotte Street place. Is that right? Was it?
Yes.
You'd like to know who it was that lost it, eh?
I'm not going to bargain with you, Freeman.
I just want to be bloody sure I'm not being framed. When I walk out of that identification parade without being fingered by anybody, then I'll tell you who I lent it to.
Thank you.
Are you ready, sir?
In a moment, my good man. That's a promise.
I wasn't there. Perhaps he was.
Freeman was not identified by anybody. True, only two persons, the constable and the porter, had seen the killers without their masks, but neither was able to point out any person in the lineup at all. Freeman, in high glee, returned to my room.
The fellow I let the raincoat to is Charlie Mortimer.
Within the hour, criminal records had supplied us with details of Charles Mortimer, whose record showed he had served two terms at Dartmoor for armed robbery. Two detective constables were sent at once to his last address of record. Mr. Mortimer was not at home, but in his room were found three Patek Philippe watches. They were at once identified as part of the loot from a jewelry shop robbery at Queensway in Bayswater, a few days before the one in which the man de Bruyne was killed. Well, I said to Sergeant Quinn, our friend Mortimer may not be the murderer we want, but he'll have some explaining to do.
Why don't you think he's the murderer?
I didn't say that. I said he may not be the murderer.
Well, sir, if he had the raincoat...
If.
Yes, sir.
I've seldom heard of people like Freeman implicating others in murder.
Except for a reason.
To get even is the phrase.
There's another thing. If Mortimer was in on the jewelry shop job in Bayswater...
As he obviously was. At least he had those three watches.
Well, if he was, why should he try armed robbery again 2 days later, sir?
That's a very important point, Quinn.
I think so.
Well, when we find Mortimer, we'll have a lot of questions to ask.
We'll find him.
Oh, excuse me. Inspector Anderson here. Oh, hello, Thomas. You have? Good. Where? We found him.
Mortimer?
Yes. Hello, Thomas. Where is he now? Oh, here. Well. Send him in.
I'll go get him, sir.
Good. Quinn's coming to fetch him. Didn't talk. Didn't ask him any questions. Good. Let him think it's the Bayswater job he's been nabbed for. Right. And may I say that's very fine, quick work. Quinn will be there any second. Quite. Goodbye, old boy. Hello. Inspector Anderson again. Will you ring George and ask him how soon he can get those people together again? The people that attended the identification parade this morning. The ones on the Charlotte Street murder case. What's the number? 160277. Thank you. Ask him to let me know as soon as he can, will you? Thank you. What is it the Americans say? We're in business. Ah, Sergeant Quinn.
This is Mortimer, sir. Go on in.
You may sit down, Mortimer.
No.
Sit down, Quinn.
Thank you, sir.
Has he been charged?
Yes, sir. Accessory to armed robbery.
Warned, of course.
Anything I say may be taken down in writing and used as evidence. Ask me no questions, I'll tell you no lies.
Let me ask you one, Mortimer. Where's your raincoat?
Out there at the desk.
I mean the one you borrowed.
What did I borrow one for? I've got one.
I thought you borrowed one from Arthur Freeman.
From Artie Freeman? Now, look here, mister. Artie Freeman's been looking for me ever since I... Ever since that jewelry shop job in Bayswater that your bloody coppers pulled me in for. Do you think he'd lend me anything?
Why is Artie Freeman looking for you, Mortimer?
He's promised to cut me throat the minute he sees me.
This is how Charles Mortimer explained that somewhat astonishing statement. It was on the day that Arthur Freeman was released from a Borstal institution, where, as a juvenile delinquent, he had served a long sentence. A friend of his, a certain Basil Green, another ex-Borstal boy, and Charles Mortimer had arranged a welcome home party for Arthur at a pub in Clerkenwell. It's quite a party, Mortimer said. After the other guests had departed, Arthur Freeman and Charles Mortimer sat at a table together and talked. The third man, Green, was asleep on the floor.
Welcome home again, Artie, old boy.
Welcome home to you, Shy.
Plenty happy returns.
That's right. You drink.
Yeah, after you.
You. I got here some money.
Well, I got 2 half crowns.
More than that.
I ain't got no more.
Maybe Basil's got some. Hey, Basil.
Hi, Manny.
He's asleep.
Well, he is.
Take your foot off his face.
Why?
Gotta be polite.
I'm polite. I need money, I'm stony.
Let's go get some.
All right. You know where?
I know a jewelry shop.
Let's go rob it.
That's what I mean.
Take Basil with us. He's got a gun.
I ain't got a gun.
I'll borrow Basil's.
Where is this jewelry establishment?
Huh?
Bayswater. Queensway Bayswater.
Listen, you double cross me, I cut your heart out.
Oh, I ain't gonna double cross you.
Better not. I slit your throat, boy.
Just don't worry about your pal Charlie Morton, old boy.
When we do it?
What?
Rob jewelry shop, kill people in shop, get jewels.
I got the place all figured out. Been casing it.
Tightened sides.
That's right.
Where we'll do it?
Tomorrow.
Oh, listen.
Listen,
I'm not kidding about this, Charlie. I ain't had a sixpence of my own for so long. What a bloody farthing. I've got to have money.
Let go!
And if I have to kill somebody to get it, that's all right, too. If I got to kill to get money, I'm the lad who'll do it. Look at me, Charlie. And I don't care who I kill. And that goes for you, too, if you cross me up.
I'm not
going to think
I'm a crook.
Meet me in Basil tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock on the down platform at Bayswater. I'll bring Basil's gun. We're going to be rich, Clark.
That was the way the first robbery began. The first association of Arthur Freeman, Basil Green, and Charles Mortimer. The affair was quite successful from their standpoint, and the three men separated, Mortimer carrying the loot. Mortimer went directly to a receiver of stolen goods and disposed of all but the three watches we found in his lodgings. A thoroughly dishonest crook. The rage of Arthur Freeman was terrible to behold when he came to Mortimer's deserted lodgings and found only the three watches Mortimer told us. He told us more.
I heard from Basil Green that he raged. Simply raged, sir. Cut me throat from ear to ear, he said. Cut me up in little pieces and feed them to me, he promised. I was fair upset. Gentlemen, I never kill nobody. I knowed he'd do what he said because I know the knife he carries. I'll be safe in prison, won't I? Won't I? I'm bloody weary of dodging Artie Freeman. I was just on my way to a boat for South America when your Scotland Yard gentleman picked me up. You saw the tickets.
Inspector Anderson sent me to pick up Basil Green and Arthur Freeman. I found Green easily enough, but our chief suspect, Freeman, had disappeared. At an identification parade, Green was quickly identified by those present at the Charlotte Street murder. No one even looked at Mortimer. Green was placed under arrest for complicity in the latter case. Mortimer was tried and convicted for the Bayswater robbery. Green, a rather simple-minded young spiv, decided to make a statement.
Yes, sir, my own free will in the court. Yes, sir, I understand what I say will be used in evidence.
Go ahead, Green.
Well, sir, where'll I start?
Wherever you like.
Well, sir, I was asleep when they planned it.
But you mean when Mortimer and Freeman planned the first robbery?
Huh? Yes, sir, that's what I mean. Artie and me and Charlie went to Bayswater and we did that thing.
You mean the robbery?
Huh? Yes, sir, that's what I mean. Charlie took the stuff we got, and when Artie and me went to find him, he was gone. You know about that, sir. And then Artie got awful mad, and he cursed, and he...
What did he say?
Well, I couldn't repeat that, sir. There's a lady present.
Miss Bellamy will hold her ears.
Yes, sir. Well, he threatened Charlie and said he'd cut off Charlie's bloody ears and cut his throat and stab him and murder him.
That is Charles Mortimer you're referring to.
Huh? Yes, sir, that's what I mean. So, then he said we had to have some money right away.
You're now referring to Arthur Freeman?
Huh? Yes, sir, that's what I mean. He said he wouldn't give me my gun back, and we'd go and stick up another jewelry store right away, and I told him I knew a little about this place in Charlotte Street. He said, all right, let's go. We went and looked at it, and the next morning we did it.
What'll I say now, sir?
Whatever you like.
Well, sir. We have those masks on. We used that Bayswater. As soon as we went in the place, somebody shouted, and somebody must have pressed a buzzer or something. Naughty yelled out. He cursed, sir. And we run out, and there was this man, this De Bruyne, or whatever his name was. He was just coming in the door, and he said, stop, and Naughty cursed again and shot the man, and we ran. Now, masks was falling down, and we hit a man in the other building. We run right through it and out the back, and Oddie took off his raincoat. It used to be his brother George's. He was a very nice fellow.
You are now referring to George Freeman as a nice fellow.
Huh? Yes, sir, that's who I mean. Oddie wasn't. Isn't, I mean. Well, Oddie swore at the raincoat and said he could be identified by it and threw it away. That's the way it was, sir.
Your statement will be given to you after it's typed.
What for, sir?
For you to read and sign.
Sir, I can't read very good. Well, I know where you can find Artie if you want him, sir.
You know where he is?
Yes, sir. You'll die when I tell you, sir. Should I tell you, sir?
If you like, Green.
Well, sir, he's in jail.
And there he was, in Brixton jail. We hastened there, and the warder took us down to the cell block, where after a long walk, we finally found our man. He grinned through the bars at me.
Hello, Inspector.
Hello, Freeman.
How'd you find me?
Your friend Basil Green told us.
I'll kill him for that.
I doubt it.
What are you in for, Freeman?
Error. I broke a policeman's jaw. I thought they'd send me up for a while for that. By the way, my name's William Patterson in here.
Good place to hide out.
Not good enough.
I got a little bothered about you, you see.
Obviously.
You found Charlie Mortimer?
Yes.
And he talked.
At great length. Just as Basil Green did.
Unlucky for me.
Oh, no. We came to get you out of here.
Oh, yeah.
And take you elsewhere. Arthur Freeman, I arrest you on a charge of willful murder. I warn you that anything you say will be taken down in writing and may be used in evidence. Unlock the door, please, Warder. At the trial at Old Bailey, both Arthur Freeman and Basil Green were found guilty of the murder of Anthony De Bruyne and were sentenced to be hanged. The sentence was duly carried out.
You have heard another in the series Whitehall 1212, compiled by special permission from the Spiles of Scotland Yard. Only the names have been changed. Research for Whitehall 1212 is prepared by Percy Hoskins of the London Daily Express. The stories for radio are written and directed by Willis Cooper.
That's it for Case Closed this week. If you want to find more from this podcast, find all the other podcasts, our Shoutcast stream, and our donate button, just visit the website at relicradio.com. Your donations there make all of this possible. Thanks, as always, for those who have. Thanks for joining me today. Talk to you again next Wednesday with another hour of old-time radio crime on Case Closed. Case Closed is produced by and for relicradio.com. Rebroadcast of this show without permission is strictly prohibited.